Well, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Tatiana. That was really beautiful. I had forgotten that this is sort of a adopted second church home, isn't it? Having spent a few months here previously. I saw Mr. Salyer kick this platform out of the way when he left, and I thought, well, we're about the same height, so fairly close. And I thought, well, maybe he just wants to see if I can kick it up without falling over myself. So managed to do that. It was good to be back here. We were trying to remember when the last visit was. I was thinking 3 years ago. He said 2 years ago. I just don't remember. The only thing I know is that time flies, and it's been too long. And my wife wasn't able to make it last time, and sure enough, she came down with the fungus among us that's been going around. I don't know how it's been here, but it has just devastated the office over the last month. Up in Allen, we've had, I think, 13 employees have spent 4 or 5 days each out of work getting all of this, and we thought we were just about through it, and one of them came down sick on Monday, and then my wife came down sick on Tuesday, and still not past it, so whatever it is really been going through the system, and so she sends her regrets and apologies and wishes she could have made it, but I had scheduled this and canceled it not long ago, and I had already made an appointment with my aunt to take her to lunch tomorrow on the way back home. I haven't seen her in a number of years, so wanted to go ahead and come anyway, even if it meant without her. So we'll try to get back another time when she can make it. Before getting into the sermon, a few notes about media. We are preparing a more extensive report to send out to all of the churches just before the Days of Unleavened Bread. We like to do that before the spring and the fall holy days, and the report this year is going to be very encouraging. I don't know how many of you might have seen In Accord this week. Mr. Franks talked about that, but we passed a milestone. March was our first month to have over 1 million unique visitors in 1 month to the Life, Hope, and Truth website. So that was really exciting to us. We came close last year. March of last year, we had 922,000. And it had been on an upward trend. And then after March, it sort of leveled off and went down through the summer months. And then in September, it started climbing again. And we've seen that trend going up. It's interesting. You try to figure out why. You know, why do numbers grow? Why do numbers drop? You can't always just figure it out. And we were a little disappointed last summer when it fell off and then leveled out, but then when it started creeping back up, and then, you know, we have seen over the decades that sometimes in the summer things would tend to fall off somewhat over the years. I don't know if that's going to be a long-range trend or not. I hope it's not a trend where it levels off. I hope it just keeps rising. But as we've watched them grow, and then in March, we had a million and almost 30,000, 1,029,363 unique visitors. And I think it's been a bit of an education for the whole church over the last 4 years of having an internet-based preaching the gospel to learn what some of these terms mean. But a unique visitor, those are not all the visitors we had, but the unique visitors are separate individuals. And so to pass that mark was quite a highlight for us. And that was a 12% growth over March of a year ago. Those unique visitors year to date are an 18% increase over the same time a year ago of January, February, and March for the year to date. So we've had 2,836,000 unique visitors in the first 3 months of the year. So that's really, really encouraging to us. Those visitors are also engaging us more in terms of writing in questions, not just comments, but questions. Personal correspondence group that we have, a group of a handful of ministers who answer the questions that are sent in. They answered 438 questions in the month of March, which was a 43% increase over March of a year ago. So more and more people are writing in. Some of the questions are very simple. Some are quite complex. Some are you can tell people are thinking and reading, and it's always interesting to to get these questions and what is on people's minds and what kind of help they're looking for. I mentioned in a court a few weeks ago that unique visitors are good. We are just as concerned, though, about some other important areas where the numbers aren't so big, but the numbers are very important. And that is, we want people not only to come to the website, but it's even more important to come back to the website. Come back, stay longer, and visit more pages. That's when you know somebody is spending more time. And so we're working on that, and we're working on some internal promotion to marketing to try to affect that, where people will go from one page to another. And some of it is just simply as simple as putting an advertisement on a page and where you put it on a page. 30 Degrees North was in the office on Wednesday, and we were discussing some of those things where they may have an advertisement, let's say, for a booklet. And instead of putting it at the bottom of the page when somebody finishes reading it, let's put it halfway up the page. So in the middle of their reading it, they'll see that advertisement. And just in case they don't make it all the way to the end of the page, let's put that advertisement higher and try to get them to order that booklet or to take it another step further to go to another page. So all of these are things that go into the mix in terms of trying to promote it. But we're just very delighted. Those unique visitors, that's sort of the broad sowing of the seed, and yet we want that seed to take root. And, you know, we are convinced that it will. I forget the exact number Mr. Frank said. I think it was about 70, if I recall correctly, of people who have contacted ministers in the United States in the first 3 months of the year. About half of them are former associates of the church in one way or another, but about half are not. Some of them are brand new people, and that's really exciting. Also, last weekend, I'll go ahead and mention this. I think it'll be coming out. I think Mr. Franks might have mentioned that in this week's In Accord. Mr. Meeker was in Montreal last weekend. He has been corresponding with a small group of people in that area. Some of them have been associated with other churches. Some have not been going anywhere for years. Some of them go back to 30, 40 years ago, to worldwide days. But there was a group that got in touch with him and different individuals, so it came the time for him to go up and meet with them. So they had 8 people for services last week in Montreal, and there were a few others who were not able to make it, but who are also French-speaking in the Quebec area. And it was very well received, a good long question and answer session after the services, and the decision was made to start a congregation in Montreal, and also to host a small feast site this year. So he started looking on Monday for a feast location, and it'll be a bilingual site, and he and Mr. Angelou will split their time between France and Montreal, or Quebec, for the feast this year. But he said they were very excited, the members, and he said some of them just sort of were taken aback that we would try to do something like that for them immediately, provide a feast and provide a Sabbath service. So that was very encouraging, as well as some of the growth that is being seen in the European area of French-speaking areas. And he also said that last week we passed 1,000 unique visitors for one day on the French website, the Life Open Truth website. So that's very encouraging as well. And so things are moving along that way. You sort of have mixed emotions when it comes to seeing things about preaching the gospel. You're so grateful for what has been done. You turn around and look at there's so much yet to do. But nevertheless, all you can do is have everybody work as hard as they can, and then God does the rest. And I have no doubt, though, that He is at work in the lives of people, still working in people's minds and hearts calling. And someday, you know, you'll get that phone call or the door opens and somebody walks to the door for the first time that God has been working with. And you know then that word going out is producing some fruit. So I'd be happy to talk with you after services about any element of media that you would like, but there will be a bigger report coming that will be passed on to you in the next couple of weeks. question for us today in here is, what motivates you? What motivates you? What drives you? And what are you driven to do in life? What keeps you focused? What keeps you committed? Everything we do, although most of the time we don't consciously think about it, but everything we do is motivated by something. Something motivates us to do whatever it is that we do, big or small. There are some big issues in life, though, that are really important when it comes to motivation. What are you motivated to do? What motivates you? How deeply does your motivation run? Is it constant, or does it sort of ebb and flow? And as you well know, our focus is spiritual. So the main element that we're talking about in life is our spiritual lives. What motivates us? Motivation is defined as the inner stimulation for action. What is it that is the inner thing that stimulates you to act, to do something? It comes from a root word, the root of motive. Where does motive come from? Well, as you trace the development of that word, it literally comes from some old words that means moving. Moving. And so motivation is that which inwardly moves a person to act in a certain way. So what is it that inwardly moves us to act in certain ways? As we think about the meaning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, it doesn't take long to think that motivation is a big part of fulfilling the responsibilities of unleavened bread, putting sin out of our lives, or striving to put the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth into our lives. We have to be motivated to do these things. And then we think about how the Feast of Unleavened Bread comes right on the heels of the Passover, and it is also a pretty quick connection between the two, that the meaning of the Passover has a lot to do with our motivation to act in such a manner that the days of unleavened bread represent, what that is all about. The meaning of the Passover plays a huge part in generating our motivation. And if you're around the church for enough years, you can observe in your own lives as well as in the lives of others that when people are growing spiritually, when you see someone growing spiritually, developing the fruit of God's Spirit, overcoming sinful practices, or being better at blocking those sinful practices at the door when the temptation comes up, as we grow in our ability to do that, you will always see motivated people. They are motivated to do these things. And yet we will also see, it's interesting, that we all know, we all understand. All we have to do is look at our own lives over a period of time, and we understand that motivation does not always run at the same speed and the same consistency for all of us, does it? Sometimes we're more highly motivated to do things than we are at other times. What causes that? What is the inner drive that pushes us and makes us move to act in certain ways? We can even see motivation wane sometime. What was a strong motivating force at one time may later not be as effective in our lives. And it can also come back. So it's not a constant in that sense. And there's an interesting statement that Peter wrote in 2 Peter 1. In verse 9, he says, "For he who lacks these things." Now, what was he talking about? He who lacks what? Well, he was referring to what precedes this verse, where he talked about add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge, to knowledge self-control, to self-control perseverance, to perseverance godliness, brotherly kindness, and love. So those are all great things that we need spiritually, aren't they? So he said, he who lacks these things, you might say, well, why would anybody who's a Christian lack any of those? Wouldn't it be assumed that we'd be growing in all of those things? Well, let's not assume that. Peter did not assume it. And he said, anybody who lacks these things has something going on. And he mentions two things. The first one has to do with vision. He says, anybody who lacks these things is short-sighted. And then the second thing he mentions is motivation. Anybody who lacks these things is short-sighted, even to blindness, and has forgotten that he was cleansed from his old sins. That forgetting that we were cleansed from our old sins, I think, has a lot to do with how motivated we are. It's remembering some things that keeps us motivated, because at one time, if we were really motivated to grow spiritually, we were very aware of what God had done for us. We were very intently aware, and we had not forgotten these things, and we were motivated to serve God. But if we lack these things, a lack of spiritual growth, Peter ties that to forgetting. And the implication is very clear. Remember, and you'll be motivated to act. You'll be motivated to be growing. One of the main reasons why God has us keep the Passover every year is to prevent forgetfulness. That's one of the things God says about it. We eat and drink in what? In remembrance of me. God wants us to remember, come together every year and keep this every year. He says, remember, do this in remembrance of me. We remember him, first of all. And if you remember him, you can't help but go to the next step to remember the covenant that we made, that you made with him. And that helps us to maintain and shore up our motivation. The deeper the understanding and the impact of the Passover, the deeper our motivation will be. I want to tell you the story today. A story of a person whom I'm quite certain could never keep the Passover without remembering some of the most dramatic events of his life. And he was a person like you and me. He had been called. God had worked with him. And he went through a time of learning a lot. But like all of us, one of the things we learn is that the things we learned by themselves don't convert us. We have to have the knowledge. We have to have the truth and the knowledge of God. But knowledge alone just doesn't convert us. There are a lot of people who know a lot of things of God who've never been converted. It takes something more than that. It takes something that really moves us. Something has to strike us more deeply to move us to act on the knowledge, to be committed to following God, to be committed to changing according to what we learn about following God. And we also learn that motivation has to stay constant throughout our lives. It has to remain for this person that we're going to read his story. I have no doubt that what happened to him was something that motivated him for the rest of his life. It had to be a powerful influence on his life. His story has parallels to our stories. Now, the events of his life were not necessarily very similar to the events of our lives, but the story has its similarities. You know, each one of us has our story. You probably do this at a lot of nights to be much observed. I enjoy when we go to somebody's home or we sit in a restaurant, and after we've been eating the meal or maybe during the meal, we start going around the table and everybody tells their story of how they left Egypt. How did God bring you into his church? How did God bring you out of the world and into this way of life? I never get tired of hearing those stories. And for some of us, second and third and fourth generation story, it begins with our parents or our grandparents' story. And every third and fourth generation Christian ought to know the story of the first generation in their family of how did you come to be here. In Exodus 13, it tells, God had inspired Moses to tell Israel, you tell your children how you came out of Egypt. And so when we tell those stories, they never get old. They're all different, and they're all the same. they're all different. And, well, I first heard the broadcast. I first read the magazine. You know, something is different. I remember a man, an elder in the Philippines, Mr. Florante Chopin, telling me the story about walking down the street, pondering. He was a Baptist, and he had been pondering the question about born again. He could not figure it out. There were holes in his understanding. And he said a piece of trash blew across the sidewalk. And he was a conscientious person, and he grabbed that piece of trash, and he said he picked it up, and it was half of a page of a magazine that had been torn off. And he said he picked it up, started to wad it up, and he looked at it, and on the bottom half was the answer to his question about being born again. Explanation of some scripture. And it was amazing to him. And he flipped it over, and on the back side was how to order the plain truth. Somebody had torn a piece of paper off, and it just happened to blow across his path. Well, he never believed that. Nobody believes that. God had a way of putting it. It's a fascinating story. Well, you might say, well, that's a lot. That beats my story all to pieces. Well, it's just different. But everybody has a story. There was a story of how you came to be here. What God did, it was God's working in one way or another in our lives. We all had that experience, and it's delightful to hear those. This person that we're going to look at, his story is very instructive, and it's very inspiring. Now, his calling was admittedly quite a bit more dramatic than probably any of ours was, as was his entire life. His entire life was pretty dramatic. We have far more written about him than any of the other apostles who walked with Christ, including his strengths and his flaws. We don't get to choose what goes into our stories, do we? When it's in the Bible, God's the one who chose what would go in there. And I'm sure there are things that some of the characters in the Bible would just assume that episode in their life would not have been included. But God includes it. He shows the strengths and the blemishes. The warts and everything else are there. And he does that to help us identify, because we all have our warts and blemishes. And it sets an example for us of what God can do in a person's life. There seems to be only one reason why so much was recorded about this man, especially his failings. And that is because we can see ourselves in him. We can identify. And therefore, we can learn. That man is Peter. He's quite a dramatic individual. Now, the word motivation is never mentioned with Peter's life. In fact, the word motivation is not in the Bible at all. The word isn't there. There are a lot of examples about it. But when you read his story and you put yourself in his place, there are things that you say, I could never forget this. I would never forget what happened. How could you forget it? It would stick with you for all of your life. It would shape your thinking. It would mold and shape your life forever. And it did him. Peter was a spiritual giant, a man used mightily by God. As you begin reading church history in Acts chapter 2, the works of this man are very obvious. And from the beginning of the church, you see Peter being used very effectively by God. To this day, well, I was telling Mr. Salyer this last night, I think it was Mr. and Mrs. Salyer, that I'm going on the Israel trip in June. And I get to give the afternoon sermon on the day of Pentecost in Jerusalem this year. And I'm thinking, what do you say? What do you talk about on that day? And then I turn and I read Acts 2. And I think, I could work every day from now until we go there on a sermon and still not come up with something like Peter gave. And he did it on the spur of the moment. I'm sure Christ did not meet with the fellows 3 days after he reappeared to them after he was resurrected and say, hey guys, Peter, you're on for the morning sermon on Pentecost, so, you know, start working on that. Didn't happen that way. But under that spontaneous inspiration of God, you read Acts 2 and you think, what a brilliant message. But it wasn't Peter's brilliance. It was God's inspiration, but it was a brilliant, brilliantly laid out message. If you just look at it as in terms of a message, the way it was constructed and the way it led to this convicting point was amazing. Then you go to chapter 3 and you read the same thing. Once again, it happened. God used him to move other people. People's lives were changed. In Acts 4, you read of Peter being arrested and brought before the Sanhedrin. And then he witnesses in a very powerful way in front of them. And then as soon as it's over, he immediately, humbly, goes to God and prays for strength. In Acts 5, you read how he discerned about Ananias and Sapphira, discerned that they were lying against God's Spirit. And he goes through that situation that deeply affected the church. And then later in the chapter, he again is put on trial. In Acts 10, he is sent to Cornelius. And the door is opened to the Gentiles, and God revealed an understanding about this that was to impact the church dramatically when they realized God is giving his Spirit to the Gentiles. And he used Peter to do that. And then when you later read his two letters that he writes, 1st and 2nd Peter, written decades later, they are so deep and so powerful and so instructive. And again, it's so obvious that God was working in him. If all we had was the book of Acts and 1st and 2nd Peter, we would be really impressed with Peter. We'd be really impressed, and we would see, well, it's pretty obvious why God chose him. I mean, he is a natural born leader, and he is Mr. Personality, and he's a giant of faith, and he has courage like a lion. And we would say, what a man, what a guy. And we would be wrong. We would be wrong in our conclusion about what Peter was. Without the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, we wouldn't know that he wasn't always that way. Peter wasn't. The Peter we see in Acts is not the same Peter we see in the Gospels. And we wouldn't know that truly all the credit goes to God and the working of God's Spirit in Peter's life. The Peter we see on the day of Pentecost and following in the book of Acts is not the same Peter. Without the Spirit of God, Peter was a guy with a big personality. He was just a guy with a big personality, which, for all the good it did him, got him into an equal amount of problems. He did have a certain type of strong personality that was different from a lot of people, but, you know, it got him in a lot of trouble. For 3.5 years prior to what we read in Acts, he had some intensive training under Jesus Christ, and that training is a fascinating study in itself. There were numerous occasions that molded and shaped Peter's understanding and his faith and his character, but it all culminated in a life-changing experience in a very brief period of time that must have changed and impacted his motivation forever. It was on the evening of the Passover, the last Passover that Jesus kept. This event is recorded in all four Gospels, and each Gospel shows it in a little different way. John's Gospel is the most forgiving account. Doesn't have a lot of detail. It only says in John's Gospel that Peter denied that he knew the Christ. Mark's is a little more descriptive. In Mark 14 and verse 72, it says, the second time the cock crew, and Peter called to mind the word that Jesus said unto him, before the cock crow twice, you shall deny me three times. And when he thought thereon, he wept. Matthew's account tells more of the story. It's fairly detailed. But Luke adds something that none of the others mention, and it's very important and it's very poignant. Let's go to Luke chapter 22. Luke 22. We'll break into the story of the evening. Christ has been arrested, beginning in verse 54. We'll pick up this story about Peter here. Luke 22:54. Then having arrested him, they led him and brought him into the high priest's house. And Peter followed at a distance. Now when they had kindled a fire in the midst of the courtyard and sat down together, Peter sat among them, and a certain servant girl, seeing him as he sat by the fire, looked intently at him. He's there milling around with some people. They're trying to keep warm. And there's this one girl who's just sort of zeroing in on him. Looks intently, and finally she says, "This man was also with him." But he denied him, saying, "Woman, I don't know him." In verse 58, after a little while, another saw him and said, "Hey, you're one of them." And Peter said, "Man, I am not." Then after about an hour had passed, another confidently affirmed, saying, "Surely, this fellow was also with him. He's a Galilean." And Peter said, "Man, I don't know what you are saying." And immediately, while he was speaking, the rooster crowed. And then in verse 61, we have the statement that you don't find in the other three gospel accounts. And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. That's all it says. It's the only thing it says. The Lord turned and looked at Peter. And Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he had said to him, "Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Now they were in the same room. Some historians describe that room. They said Jesus would have been at the upper end of the hall, elevated for the tribunal. I don't know how big it was exactly, but you can imagine sort of a hall like this where somebody who's brought before the tribunal is elevated up on a stage maybe, and other people are milling around, and maybe there's a fire back there around where the door is, and Peter's there. Jesus is up above where he can look down and see Peter standing near the fire. And he caught Peter's eye. And Peter remembered what he said in verse 62. Mark's account says he wept. Luke's account here says, Peter went out and wept bitterly. Bitterly. Have you ever been in a situation in life where you wept bitterly? That's something that cuts very deeply. And it seems that it's when Jesus turned and looked at Peter that that's when it sank in. That's when it really sank in. Now, what kind of look do you think he gave him? If we say, we're going to make a movie, we're going to recreate this, and you're the director, and you come to this part where Jesus looked at him, and you're telling the actor, okay, here's how I want you to look at him. You start thinking, okay, what kind of look? I mean, people can look a lot of different ways. This is all entirely speculation. We're not told. But if you stop and think, he had to look at him some way, didn't he? What kind of look did he give him? Was it a cold expression? You know, like that kind of "how could you" type of look? I don't know. Was it grief? Have you ever seen somebody look in grief like, "How could you?" You know. Was it a look of grief? Was it a look of anger? Doesn't say. Was it a look of pity? Was it a look of forgiveness? Was it a look of, was it an "I told you so" look? Just sort of. Was it maybe the look that children fear the most? The stare, you know, when parents just give them the stare. You can have your child acting up all the way across the room, and all of a sudden they catch your eye and they just settle right down because they see the stare? Was it maybe a raised eyebrow? You remember now? Do you believe me now? What kind of look was it? I don't know. We don't know. I think any of those looks could have done the job. You know, any of those looks to catch somebody's eye that you have just denied. And they told you, you would deny them. But there's more to the story. Let's go back earlier in the evening as they had gathered for the Passover. Deeply moving occasion. Let's go back in the same chapter to verse 21. The bread and the wine have been taken. And he makes a statement, Jesus does, that in verse 21, that behold, the hand of my betrayer is with me on the table. And truly the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. And then they started to talk about what would be the natural question. Who would do this? So in verse 23, they began to question among themselves which of them it was who would do this thing. Now, if we wouldn't ask the question openly, we would sure think it, wouldn't we? Who is here, and you're looking around, these people you've known for 3.5 years, friends, you know each other well, and he just said, the hand of my betrayer is here at the table, and there's no Roman soldiers, and there's no Pharisees. It's just the band of brothers. That had to be a deeply moving thing to see. But then something else comes up. In verse 24, there was also rivalry among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. You can't help but read that and say, well, how does a conversation move from who's going to betray to which one of us is the greatest? Think, boy, that's a whiplash for a conversation, isn't it? But it's not really too hard to think how that might have happened. Somebody who's going to betray him, well, I never would. I would never betray him. In fact, I know I'm going to be in the kingdom with him. Well, so am I. It's pretty soon the conversation can move, and then it slides right on over. And this was actually the third time in their 3 years of training that this had happened. Same issue, once again, that Jesus has to take time out from all the things he's going through and address this, because it settles into a rivalry. There was a rivalry among them. Rivalries among the brethren are not good, are they? They reveal something that is spiritually wrong. They reveal some values, but they were motivated. They were motivated to get into a rivalry as opposed to being motivated to standing apart from that. Motivation can be very powerful. And so he said to them, look, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. And those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors, but not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he who governs as he who serves. And the first time he'd had to deal with this issue, maybe a couple of years before, the first time it came up, it was the time when he called a little child in the middle of them, and he said, fellas, you're worrying about who's the greatest in the kingdom? He said, you need to worry about being in the kingdom. And until you can become like this little child, he said, you will. He makes a very scary statement. He said, you will by no means enter the kingdom. You're not even going to be there, he said, if you can't get this fixed. Now, you would think that would be pretty good motivation to not ever let that be a problem again. But it shows the insidious nature of human thinking. And so they slipped right back into this. And so now's the third time, and he mentions it again. And he said, for who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. But he didn't leave them hanging. He does recognize something in them. He knows they're growing. He knows they're changing. And he ends this with a very encouraging statement. He said, "But you are those who have continued with me in my trials. And I bestow upon you a kingdom, just as my Father bestowed one upon me, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel." Well, after being confronted for the third time about this issue, that did have to be a bit encouraging to them to hear him say, "I prepared you to rule in my kingdom. That's why you've been called at this time. And you will." But then he went on. The Lord said, and he turned his attention right to Peter, and he said, "Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat." What would you think if Christ appeared in person at the Passover this year? And in a discussion, called your name, and he said, "Satan has asked for you that he can sift you like wheat." I think that'd be a full body shiver, wouldn't it? Whoa. What does that mean? I'm not entirely sure. The image of Job comes to mind, maybe, where Job was just saying, "Let me at him. Let me at him." But he said in verse 32, "But I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." The King James Version says, "When you are converted, when you're turned around." Now, you know, brethren, we're all going to be sifted in life, aren't we? You know what sifting was? The sifting was done by throwing grain up into the air with a slight breeze blowing and allowing the wind to blow away the chaff. That's how they separated the grain from all the chaff. Now, when it's us that's being thrown up in the air by life, we don't particularly like that, and it's not easy to be tossed around. But that's often how some of the chaff is separated out of our lives, isn't it? When we go through trials and we come out of it, we survive, and we've learned some things. We are sifted. And he told Peter, "When you come to your senses, and when you've learned the lesson, and when you've returned to me, I want you to help other people. Strengthen your brethren. Be a help to them." Well, put yourself in Peter's shoes. You're hearing this being said. Guess what? Peter thought that's where he was. Peter was, in his mind, he was, "I'm already there." Peter says to him, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. I'm with you. I'm already turned. I'm right here. Got your back." And that's when he said, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day before you are going to deny me three times." You think you're with me? No, you're not with me. Before sunup, you will have denied me, not once, not twice, three times. But that's not the way Peter understood it. We need to add Matthew's account because it fills in some extra information that is very pertinent to this story. Let's go to Matthew 26. Keeping in mind what we've just read, let's add now what we find here. Because it wasn't just Peter. You might put yourself in the situation here and say, "Okay, what would I have said that night? How would I have reacted that night? I'm there, real life, what would I say?" Verse 31, Jesus said to them, "All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." This prophecy in Zechariah, he said, this is how it's going to be fulfilled. You guys are going to be offended. You'll stumble and be scattered. "But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee." Peter answered and said to him, "Even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble." Now, not only was he making himself look good, he was sort of imputing that the others, there's a possibility that they might. Even if all the rest of them do, that's a possibility, you know, it could happen, but I won't. I will never do this. I will never, ever do that. Jesus said to him, "Assuredly, I say to you, this night before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you." I won't. He was motivated. He said that because he was motivated. And, you know, there's no denying that he wanted, this was on his mind, he was going to do the right thing. Have you ever been in the moment where you were so motivated and you're talking with God, maybe on your knees, talking about something that you've done? Have you ever made a statement, "Father, I'm never going there again. I won't do that again. I am so sorry. I'm not going to do that again. It won't happen. I hate what I've done." And then next month you find yourself, "Oh, I did it again." You know, that motivation you had at the moment, that inspiration, that dedication you had at the moment, that was so real and so much in your mind that and it's true, you don't want to do it again. But then later on, circumstance change, life changes, and we can make the same mistake. But here's the thing. Let's finish the verse. So said all the disciples. Everybody felt that way. And you know, that is genuinely the way they felt. That's what they wanted. That's what they intended. That's what they saw themselves doing. What would we have said that night? In the right time, in the right place, given the right circumstances, we could have said the same thing. Because, hey, I look back on my life, I've stumbled over less than this before. I've stumbled over things far less of a pressure situation than what they were in, going to find themselves in. Here's the point. Without God's Spirit, without God's help, we're no different from Peter. We're no different than the rest of them. We're just different personalities. You may not be Mr. Type A, who jumps at the head of the group every time and says, "Hey, follow me. I'm in here. Tell me to walk on the water. I'm out, you know, I've got my sword. I'll take off his ear for you." You know, there are some people who are just always, they're just the person, the big personalities. We may not be the big personality. We may have a totally different personality, but human nature is the same. Human nature is the same. We can easily see ourselves in Peter, and that's why his story is preserved for us. This story is not in here just to make Peter look bad, you know. It's so that we can learn. Now, let's think for a few minutes about the circumstances that Peter later, after all this is over, later, he could reflect on. We've all been in places in life, and at the moment, it's tough, it's emotional. And maybe you do the right thing, maybe you do the wrong thing, and then later you start to debrief. You go back later and you think about what you did, and you may think about it for years. Things may come to mind for years later that you think about. I did this. Why did I do it? What led me that way? There were things that came out of this evening that Peter could have thought about for the rest of his life, over and over. Things that you reflect on that would make that denial. Why was the denial so painful? When Jesus looked at him and Peter remembered and he goes out, he runs out of that room and he goes and throws himself somewhere on the ground or against a tree or against a wall and he weeps bitterly. Bitterly. You don't forget that. You think about that. There are several things that he could have reflected upon for the rest of his life that have some very distinct parallels to our lives. Number one, the first was the rank that he held among the followers of Jesus. There were a lot of people who followed Christ from time to time. But Peter was more than just an ordinary disciple. He was one of the 12. There were 12 who were called to be apostles. And of those 12, he was one who was, in a sense, by indications, that was one of those closest to Christ. He had been given several privileged opportunities that not all of them had. What is the parallel for us? Brethren, we are not ordinary disciples. We are not ordinary disciples. We have been called out of this world. They were all called out of their world. Notice 1 Peter chapter 2. A set of verses that we're probably familiar with. 1 Peter 2, beginning in verse 1. Says, therefore, laying aside all malice, all guile, hypocrisy, envy, evil speaking, as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby, if indeed that you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. You think Peter wrote verse 3 with maybe a little bit of feeling, a little bit of personal? If you have tasted that the Lord is gracious, I think Peter could look back at that night and say, God has been very gracious to me. He'd tasted it. He'd tasted the salty tears on his tongue, literally, from weeping bitterly. He had tasted it, but far more than physically, that's a taste that stays in your mind for the rest of your life. God has been merciful. God has been gracious to me. And so coming to him as a living stone, rejected indeed by men. I wonder if that hurt Peter a little bit. Peter could remember. Yeah, I can write this. I can write this with authority. I know what it's like to be a man who rejected him. Did he shy away from it? No, he didn't. It's not like Peter said, I want to bury that in my past. I don't want to ever think about that again. No, he wrote things like this. He knew what it meant. But chosen by God and precious, you also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house. And it's God who's doing the building. A holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in the scripture, behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious. And he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, and there aren't many people in this world who believe, truly believe, to you who believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone and a stone of stumbling. And Peter could write that and say, yeah, and I stumbled. I was one of those that he said would stumble. And I didn't think I would, but I did. A rock of offense. They stumble, being disobedient to the word to which they also were appointed. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises not of ourselves. There was one time Peter proclaimed the praise of himself. We just read it. Even if all deny you, not me. What was he doing? He was praising himself. I will never deny you. That was self-confidence, self-assurance, self-proclaiming of praise. But he says, you know, the Peter writing this now has it figured out. And he said, our job is to proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy but now have obtained mercy. Beloved, I beg you, as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul. That verse 11 is really about the days of unleavened bread, meaning, isn't it? The days of unleavened bread remind us that we have to abstain from fleshly lust which war against the soul. What is our motivation? What is our motivation? The first 10 verses that precede this. In order to be moved internally to abstain from fleshly lust, we have to be motivated. And our motivation lies in what we just read earlier. Peter understood, though, that the highest favor of God, to be called by God, to be taught personally by Jesus Christ, one of the greatest privileges in life, does not mean that we are absolutely immune from the dangers of sin. It does not mean we're in a spiritual bubble, that temptation, that issues around us cannot get to us, because Peter had been there. Another thing that Peter could reflect on was that he had been warned of the danger, and he had made, in spite of the warnings, he had made great professions. He missed the warning from Christ, but the deceit that was within him didn't miss him. There was a degree of self-deceit going on in Peter's life, and it came out in the form of being presumptuous. He was presumptuous. If you hear Jesus Christ himself say, "You will all forsake me," what would be, sitting here right now, thinking logically, not emotionally, not being caught up in the moment, but sitting here thinking about this, what would be a correct reaction? If we heard Jesus Christ say, "You will all forsake me," what would be a good reaction? I think a good reaction would be, "Really? What are you, wait a minute, help me understand. Tell me, what are you talking about? I don't think I would do that, but you're telling me I will, so that must mean I will. So what's going on? Tell me, what do you know that I don't know?" You'd start asking God, "Help me to see this," but without thinking. I mean, it's almost a spontaneous reaction. Peter said, no, they can all leave you, but I won't. It's like you get caught up in reacting instead of stopping and slowing down and thinking and asking the right questions. And that comes from being presumptuous, being self-assured. At this time of the year, brethren, we focus on sin. And one of the things that God tells us about sin, always told his people, is that sin lies at the door. Sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you. And you must rule it. That's a good time to stop and think, okay, let me not be presumptuous. Let's not jump to any conclusions. I don't want to deny. Where does sin lie at my door? In what form? In what shape? Where might it be a danger spot to me? My wife called yesterday, day before yesterday it was, and said, "I stepped out the back door and right onto a snake." It's a little snake, 6 inches long. It was scared as much as she was, but they were both doing the dance, you know. Snakes don't dance, but snakes can sure move. If we were so aware of, and you know, I came home through the rest of the night, I noticed as we were letting the dog out, you know, it was like, open the door, check for snakes. I never check for snakes. I just walk out the door. I walk around the backyard barefoot at night. And now, you know, because one time nearly stepping on a snake, now all of a sudden we're very aware. What if it was that way for sin, where we were just so attuned every day, looking, where does sin lie at the door? God said it. Self-confidence that, you know, hey, we're okay. Brethren, Peter's not the only one that Satan wants to stir and sift like wheat. Self-confidence can be a great enemy, but we're very comfortable as human beings. We are very comfortable with self-confidence. We're very comfortable that, hey, I'm right. My opinion is usually right, you know. It sets up a particular kind of blindness. In 1 Corinthians 10, Paul lists five things that caused Israel to be overthrown in the wilderness. lust, idolatry, sexual immorality, tempting Christ, murmuring, and complaining. I guess that's six, isn't it? Maybe murmuring and complaining are together. But you read through that section, then you come to verse 11, and it says, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written, why? Why were these things, these stories about Israel, why were they written and preserved? They were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who stands take heed lest he fall. No temptation has overtaken you, except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. In that particular case, Peter's temptation was self-confidence. It was being presumptuous, self-assured, self-confident. We have to be aware of those things because we're no different than Peter. There's a third thing Peter could have thought about that's a parallel to us. Peter had to make his choice that night when he was confronted by those three people about, you're one of them. He had to make his choice in the presence of Christ and in the presence of the world, whether he would deny or whether maybe he thought, I might die. If I get associated with him, I might die. He had to make his choice in the presence of both God and the world. So do we. God is present with us. The world is around us. We make our choices. Just so shortly, just a few hours before, Peter had seen Jesus wash his feet. He had heard what he had said about the bread and the wine. He had defended Jesus in the garden, albeit wrongly. You know, he whipped out his sword and slashed at those who were coming to take Jesus, but his intent was, I am defending him. He had heard Jesus talking about the hand of his betrayer at being at the table. But it's just so easy when confronted with human beings. The first one he was looking at were the human beings. When his accusers came, you're one of them. You're with them. It was easier for Peter to look at the humans and deny, as opposed to looking at the humans, looking at Christ, and then making a choice of what he would do. He reacted to the humans. He reacted to the pressure that humans put on. And he looked away from God. He denied him. Whenever we deny Christ, deny doing the right things, it's usually because of one or two things. Oftentimes it's the fear of human beings, or it's simply the love of the world. We can fear what humans will think, or we can be tempted by love of the world. It's a powerful thing. 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy 2, verse 11 says this. This is a faithful saying. If we died with him, we shall also live with him. That is so important to remember. Now, living with him is explained by some of the other holy days later on in the rest of the cycle, in the annual cycle. And we will have those festivals that remind us of the future of living with him. But we also have to remember the past. If we died with him, do you remember when he died? Do you remember when you died with him? You remember why? Do you remember why you chose to die? What motivated you to be baptized? As we eat that bread and drink the wine at the Passover, as we work on getting rid of the leavening out of our premises before the feast, and as we eat that unleavened bread during the feast, do you remember why you committed to do that? Maybe your commitment was made this year. Maybe it was made 50 years ago. But we can never forget, why did I do it? What motivated me to do this? If we endure, we shall reign with him. If we deny him, he will deny us. That too has to be remembered, because people have denied Christ. People have partaken of the Passover and then turned around and denied Christ. We cannot live in assumption that that could never happen. We can never live in that assumption. If we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself. We heard the sermonette about faithfulness. It's so important to renew our commitment at the Passover, to remember the foundational faithfulness of God, what he did for us, why he did it for us, and why we in turn made a commitment for him. There's a fourth lesson you can see in Peter's denial. His denial was aggravated by repetition. His denial was aggravated by repetition, and each time he repeated the denial, it got deeper and deeper. When we begin to sin, if we don't stop it quickly, it'll get deeper and deeper. When Peter did not stop and repent at his first denial, the next one was predictable. It was predictable, and it got worse. The first time, it was just a simple denial. The second time, it increased in its vehemence, and it finally ended, Mark's version, Mark 14:71. The third time he denied, it says, he began to curse and swear and say, I do not know this man. Began to curse and swear. Strong lessons, again, that sin cannot be played around with. We cannot just let it happen and not deal with it, because it will get ingrained. Well, here's what happened. There is only one remedy, and it's the one that Peter found. Jesus earlier had told him Jesus said, I prayed for you that your faith fail not. In a sense, you can look at Peter's whole evening there, and his belief in Christ didn't fail. His 3.5 years of experience, he didn't throw that all out the window. He didn't turn his tail and run. He knew during the whole time that Christ was the Messiah. He didn't throw all of that away. But Peter had to come face to face with himself. And really what failed that night was Peter's faith in himself. That was the big failure. He had put so much faith in himself that that's what let him down. That failed him. And he began to see that night his weakness. And so we read of Peter's sorrow. He hit the wall. You know, Peter hit the wall, if you will. And later on the day of Pentecost, when he talked about crucifying Christ, and it says that they were cut to the heart. That's what happened to Peter that night. He was cut to the heart and deeply and suddenly softened. And it says he wept bitterly. And it was the sorrow of conviction. And it was the sorrow of seeing oneself and looking at what was happening to Jesus Christ there and what had happened in his own life with his own human abilities and weaknesses and failings. And it wasn't just a softening of the heart. There was something acutely deep and cutting that went with it. He wept bitterly. It's what Paul wrote about in 1 Corinthians 7 about godly sorrow. He said, godly sorrow produces repentance, leading to salvation, not to be regretted. That when you sorrow in a godly manner, what diligence it produces, what clearing of yourselves, what indignation, what fear, what vehement desire, motivation, in other words, what zeal, what vindication. That's the kind of sorrow that Peter had, and that turned him around. How do you think it affected his motivation for the rest of his life? Well, you know, you read 1 Peter. We were there earlier. Let's go back there. 1 Peter, you read what he wrote. And we already thought about that a little bit as reading through some of the earlier writings here. When Peter wrote these were things he had lived. These were things he had seen. And decades later, Peter had to be reflecting on his own experience as he wrote some of these things. And he did it. He wrote it, though, to do what Christ had told him to do, strengthen the brethren. And to this day, it strengthens us. How could he ever forget that night and the impact that it had? And he said in verse 19 of chapter 2, "This is commendable if because of conscience toward God one endures grief, suffering wrongfully. What credit is it if when you are beaten for your faults, you take it patiently? But when you do good and suffer for it, if you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps, who committed no guile, who committed no sin, nor was guile found in his mouth." I think Peter thought about that night. The guile that he had to deal with that had been found in his own mouth, to his own surprise. "Who, when he was reviled, did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but committed himself to him who judges righteously. Who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness." What is your motivation? What is your motivation to live for righteousness? "By whose stripes you were healed. For you were like sheep going astray, but now have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls." Read chapter 3 in your follow-up study to the sermon. And read, think about the man who wrote this, what he had been through, and how decades later, what motivated Peter? What motivated Peter? In chapter 4, in verse 1, he says, "Therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same mind." Same mind. "For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lust of men, but for the will of God." So, brethren, as we go into the Passover this year, let's think about what motivates me. What makes me want to do the right thing? Why am I here? What am I committing to? What did I commit to? We can't look to external sources to motivate us. You know, you can only be motivated so long by an article, by a sermon, by a conversation with somebody. Those things aren't bad. They're good. But that steady motivation that sticks with you consistently in life, that doesn't wane but actually grows stronger, comes from your relationship with God. It comes from something deeply within, a deep internal desire between you and God. So as we think about and prepare for the Passover, remember these things, think about them, be renewed. Let's be motivated more than ever before to have the life of Christ. To have the life of Christ is the Days of Unleavened Bread picture. To be living effectively in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts.